The Tom Woods Show, episode 2159.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, it's hard not to be curious about what exactly is going on in the Netherlands. There is a massive protest going on by farmers there, and we're going to talk today about exactly what it is they're unhappy about and what's being done to them and who's doing it to them and why. And we're going to be talking about this topic with somebody who has followed it very closely, and that is Kian Bexty, who is editor-in-chief over at The Countersignal, thecountersignal.com. And you can follow his reporting on this subject at DutchUprising.com. What a great domain name to snag. DutchUprising.com. Kian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I was so glad I was able to get contact with you. I noticed that your website, there's a certain badassery to the fact that I don't think there's any way to contact you through your website. So, all right. I like this kind of guy. He's making me hustle for this. So I found you.
Well, I'm glad we found each other.
Absolutely. Because I asked people, I have a private group associated with this show, who's been doing good work on this? And somebody said, well, I've been following this guy and he seems to be doing some really good reporting. Yeah, absolutely. So then I wondered, okay, I guess the mainstream media has to be saying something. So I did a little searching, and the headlines are saying things like, Dutch farmers oppose pollution cuts. So it leaves it ambiguous in your head. Well, I like farmers, but I don't like pollution, so I don't know if they're right or not. You know, so they're, of course, trying to demonize them instead of telling us what's really happening. Now, first of all, where exactly are you based right now?
I am currently, I'm based in Canada. That's where the Countersignal operates off of. Just got home after a week of reporting and thinking about going back depending on what's going on. I have a note verbal from the embassy, which allows me journalistic access to the country. That's actually how I was one of the first people there covering the story. It's kind of hard to get. So when I landed in the Netherlands, I had this whole story to break to the world because, as you said, the mainstream media that is there already, and some that have decided to mosey on over a week late, they're not doing it justice. They're not sharing the farmers' side of the story at all. They're parroting government lines. They're doing what they typically do whenever there's a popular uprising. They're defending the status quo, and they're opposing anyone who's fighting for their lives.
So speaking of that, what exactly is it that the Dutch farmers are upset about?
To distill it down, they're frustrated that the government, led by Mark Rutte, a contributor to the World Economic Forum, is going to slash nitrogen emissions, something that before I went to the Netherlands, I didn't know was an issue. I thought the atmosphere was made up of 70% nitrogen, but apparently it's a big issue to them, and they are going to slash nitrogen emissions by 40% by 2030. So in about 8 years, farmers in the Netherlands are going to have to cull 30% of their herds to meet these emissions targets while using other sort of tech to reduce the remaining 70% that they don't have to either kill or move out of the country. So when that happens, farms, they run on a tight budget. They're not the richest people on the planet. They are going to have to sell their land. And that is what the farmers believe this government really wants. They want access to the lands because it's focused on environmentally sensitive areas. And I put that in big quotation marks. Those environmentally sensitive areas just happen to be high value real estate land surrounding cities and coastline. Farmers have a hunch that the second that the pig barns are bulldozed, cheap housing for new immigrants is going to be built. That has them really frustrated. Now, their farmland has been in their family for centuries. This isn't like the United States or Canada where, you know, 200, 300 years families have owned farms. That's a long time. But these people, they've had these farms and this farmland in their family in one way or another since the 13th century in some cases. I was talking to someone who had farmland for that long. So, you know, when the government comes in and says, cough it up, we want your land or we're going to evict you because you're not going to be able to afford it anyways, people start freaking out. And they don't protest for 1 or 2 days. They don't protest for a weekend. They protest until they get what they want. And that's what we're seeing in the Netherlands right now.
It's very surprising because, I mean, I suppose when there's a knife at your throat, you do tend to fight back. But it does seem, though, that it tends to be the other side that's better and more seasoned at protesting because, you know, we tend to be bourgeois people with jobs and families and lives, and we don't specialize in organizing. And then we got the Canadian trucker protest, and now this, that, well, makes me go back and say, maybe we've got a few tricks up our sleeve. And by the way, speaking of tricks up our sleeve, you reported the other day that the Dutch farmers somehow tricked the police by claiming that there was going to be kind of like nationwide unrest. So they divided all over the country and then nothing happened.
Yeah, it was a high IQ move. You know, there's a few places you've seen high IQ protesters, and it's, you know, like think Hong Kong, where the police were shooting tear gas canisters at them and they were using liquid nitrogen to freeze the tear gas. These Dutch farmers, they have logistically complex operations. And I'll go back to one thing you said. You know, we have jobs, we have to work, so we don't typically protest. Well, these farmers, they do have jobs, but, you know, they won't have jobs if this goes through. But also, they're the masters of their own destiny. They own their farms, they have to maintain it. But, you know, if the timing is right, if planting's been done, I mean, plants are growing, cows are eating, they can go take the day off and protest. They don't have a boss in a skyscraper telling them to come into work. So they're able to choose their own schedule, protest when it works for them. And you're right, they did plan nationwide protests on Sunday. They had it going so well that even I thought this was happening. I was ready to go. And their reasoning for this was they wanted to further demoralize the police by telling the police that this was going to happen. It was going to be so big. And they were distributed all across the country. Every cop in the country was working on overtime, already demoralized, so much so that they're shooting at 16-year-old children trying to leave protests. When they had to go to work and miss another Sunday with their family, that just makes them more frustrated. And the farmers had to tend to their herds, they had to maintain their farms. So that gave them a needed break without giving the police officers any time to recuperate. And of course, the next day, you see they're already going back to the borders to blockade borders. They're blockading towns and city squares. So it's logistically complex. I wish I had a better understanding of how they were operating so I could report on it better ahead of time. But, you know, it seems to be working well for them, so they can't complain.
You know, the police issue is very interesting because up until quite recently, I think people like the Dutch farmers or people who maybe are right of center in one way or another have been inclined to give the police the benefit of the doubt. And then they watched as the police just happily enforced the most insane, fact-free, bizarre restrictions and oppressions of the past couple of years. And no problem, apparently, for them to do that. And I think some of the people who might call themselves conservatives are wondering, huh, I don't know, maybe there is a point to be made about the police. I guess they're just, quote, doing their job. But there are some jobs you just can't do. You know, you just have to say, I won't do that job. I'm not going to do this to the Dutch farmers, for example.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's what it takes for this to be successful. The Dutch have learned from the Canadians, from what they told me. They learned a lot of their tactics from the Ottawa convoy, and they were ready for similar tactics on the part of the police. The police in Ottawa, if you were following closely, I was there reporting on it, the RCMP, our National Police Service, basically our FBI, used mounted police units to trample protesters, almost killing one of them, a disabled woman. It was ruthless, and it was all on orders from our prime minister. And the same thing is happening in the Netherlands. The police are using deadly force. You know, those shots that they shot towards that 16-year-old boy, Yuka, missed his head by 2 centimeters. They would have killed him. They wouldn't have thought a second of it. They would have slept great at night. So the national police force in the Netherlands seems to be ruthless. They seem to be on the side of the government. They're not giving farmers any slack. Local police forces are a different story. And that's, from what I understand, is causing the national police force to stretch thin. Local police officers are going easy, you know, maybe giving speeding tickets for the day instead of towing away tractors like the national police force would be doing. And they're certainly not the ones that are shooting at children.
What is the actual form, I don't think we've gotten to this yet, that the protests have taken?
It's mainly large equipment based. When I was driving through Friesland, which is the northern, it's basically the Texas of the Netherlands, driving towards Amsterdam, the entire highway, it was twilight, was lined with flaming bales, like hay bales, huge hay bales. the whole highway was lit up with them. It was shocking to see, but it definitely sent a message. You could see these hay bales from anywhere. The farmers would spend the day bringing hay to the sides of the roads, and then come nighttime, they lit it on fire. And I don't know if this is common in the Netherlands or if it's new to this protest, but it was visually striking. They would even put fireworks inside of the bales while they were lit on fire so that when it got to the middle, they would explode in a huge fireball. It was like bale IEDs. I'd never seen anything like it. You know, in Canada, we had these truckers protesting. And if that was happening on the side of our roads, you know, bale IEDs, maybe that Emergencies Act that Justin Trudeau passed, I might consider to be a reasonable thing. But, you know, these Dutch farmers, they're tenacious and they're angry. And when they're put into a corner by their federal government, you have no idea what they're going to do. And that's something that resonates globally, right? Like, you've seen the same things that I've seen in Sri Lanka. The protesters are furious because, well, for one, there's energy rationing, but two, that government did the same thing that the Dutch government did. They started rationing fertilizer, saying that you can only put so much fertilizer on their crops, which causes food supply shortages, which cripples the economy inevitably. And what was their response? Well, they started burning down the prime minister's house and they raided the president's palace. So, you know, protesters, when it's their lives and lifestyle on the line, you never know what they're going to do.
Well, speaking from the United States, I can tell you, as you well know, that the media can demonize or encourage various protests. So in recent U.S. history, let's say, there were certain protests that were portrayed as favorably as possible. They were, quote, mostly peaceful, even though there are burning buildings in the background, as the reporter is saying that. You know, whereas if you and I put on a protest and we so much as gave a speech with a misplaced article or, you know, pronoun or something, yeah, we'd never hear the end of it, right? So likewise, it's very easy for the regime, wherever in the world, to demonize protests they don't approve of, that don't advance the elite's interests.
Totally.
So it makes it harder for the protesters to be able to appeal to public opinion. Is there any way to assess where Dutch public opinion stands on this?
It's really hard to say because, you know, it's different, just like in the United States. It's different if you're in New York and it's different if you're in upstate New York.
Yeah.
It's different if you're in Toronto and it's different if you're in Northern Ontario. I haven't seen any polling numbers, especially nothing that I would consider credible. You can't trust pollsters these days, especially when you don't know who paid for them. But, you know, one anecdotal story in Amsterdam, downtown Amsterdam, some farmers went to the center square there and were protesting for the release of Yuka, the boy who was shot at by police. He was arrested right after that. They were protesting for his release, and bars and pubs throughout downtown Amsterdam started bringing out flats of beers, like mugs of beers for everyone protesting, for the entire crowd. They brought these really nice mugs of beers out for them. And they were business owners. So they're different than, I would say, the normal 9-to-5 corporate worker in Amsterdam. But, you know, business owners in downtown Amsterdam coming out to support this, that's got to send a bit of a message because I don't know if you know much about Amsterdam and the politics of that city, but it's no Houston, you know, it's probably closer to Portland. So when the business owners there are supportive of this, that's a bit of a wake-up call.
How about in terms of numbers of farmers involved? Like, it was always hard to know exactly how many truckers were involved in Canada. Now, farmers, even you don't even have to have that many because each farmer probably has a, you know, considerable amount of land. Is there any sense of, can we get the scope of this thing somehow?
Yeah. So if this goes through, if by 2030, they actually end up cutting 40% of nitrogen oxide emissions, tens of thousands of farmers will be out of jobs. So that's the scale. And I would imagine that translates to how many people are protesting.
Yeah.
It's hard to say because, you know, unlike in Canada where all roads led to Ottawa, every convoy was heading to Ottawa to protest there and you could scan the city and sort of see how many people were there. In the Netherlands, the protests are everywhere. There's no centralized location. It's not even at their capital city. It's in the north. It's in the south. It's along the border. It's in Amsterdam. So it's really tough to get numbers on it. But, you know, in the five figures for sure. Is a conservative estimate.
So what exactly is the regime's end game here? Are they thinking, I mean, they know this means less food production. I mean, anybody would have to know that.
Mm-hmm.
So is it that we have to go to the, We're going to be having the World Economic Forum diet, the bugs. I mean, how do we survive, or are we not meant to survive? I mean, at least, what are they saying for public consumption to defend this?
You're on the right line of questioning, because when normal people ask themselves that and they think critically, you know, like, okay, you cut back nitrogen emissions, which is a fancy way of enchanting, you know, urban liberals into supporting it. What the real terminology you should use is cutting agriculture and agri-food production by 30% to 40%. What happens? You know, how do you get that back? Do you replace it with a substitute, aka crickets? Or is there no substitute? The price skyrockets and only the rich get to eat. That's something that needs to be answered, and the regime is not answering it. In Sri Lanka, you see what happens. Total economic collapse. Something that is totally underreported right now in my country, in Canada. Our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is doing the exact same thing and wants to reduce nitrogen use, not emissions, but fertilizer use, direct fertilizer use by 30%. And, you know, ammonia-based fertilizers feed 50% of the planet. Without it, 50% of the planet would starve within a month. So it begs the question, what's the replacement? What's going to happen? And why are so many people, Sri Lanka, Netherlands, Canada, I'd encourage you to look into your own country in the United States. Is Joe Biden pursuing something like this? Because if you reduce nitrogen use from fertilizer or emissions, food supply is going down. And that means prices going up. And certain people are going to be chosen over others to be able to eat that food. So what's going to happen? Nobody knows. It's a giant social experiment. But you know, regimes around the world are handy at those over the last 2 years. They've gotten a lot of expertise at global social experiments. So they don't seem too risk averse when it comes to just throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what happens.
You got to ask yourself, the whole climate change thing is, as James Dellingpole says, an elite project. And to the extent that the average person is concerned about it, and polling data, on this I do trust polling data, when they asked recently, what are your biggest concerns in terms of issues in the U.S., climate change was like 1%, and the economy and inflation were 33%. I mean, this is not the average person's concern. So to me, it looks as if regimes are using it as cover to get away with a lot of wicked things, as they often do with things that they use to panic people.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But what is there? I mean, it almost seems to me that I have to come to the conclusion that one country after another is ruled by people who are genuinely, utterly contemptuous of average people, mm-hmm. who take a sick, perverse pleasure in making them suffer, and then gaslighting them by blaming everybody other than themselves for what's happened to them, and then getting their kicks behind closed doors that anybody's actually falling for that and not realizing who's actually hurting them.
Yeah, you said it perfectly. You know, Mark Rutte, Prime Minister of the Netherlands, and Justin Trudeau, about 7 or 8 months ago in Belgium, were photographed with no masks on, partying it up behind a bar, getting drunk while everyone back in Canada, and I'm not sure about the COVID situation in the Netherlands at the time, but everyone back in Canada was masked up, not allowed to see their friends or family for Christmas. They were gaslighting us into thinking that our hospitals were collapsing, which really was more of an indictment on public healthcare than anything. But, you know, Justin Trudeau was still globetrotting, partying it up, laughing about us peons who were submissive and listening while they were allowed to party. And the same thing goes for climate change. You know, you shouldn't travel. You shouldn't go to Hawaii for vacation because think of the carbon emissions. But I need my private jet so that I can get to the World Economic Forum and talk about really important things like taking away your ability to travel because, you know, we have to save the climate, right? That's the important thing. And surely you understand why I need this private jet. And, you know, I need to communicate with these guys. So I'm not going to wear a mask, but you keep yours on just to be safe.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. You know, I've said for years that for so long they've said to us, there's still time. It's not too late to prevent a catastrophic outcome from climate change. It's not too late. But at some point, if you're to be taken seriously, if we haven't done anything really radical and extreme, they would have to admit, okay, now it's too late. So now we might as well just do whatever we want because now it's too late. But
you're totally right about that.
And there's so many other things. I mean, why is coastal real estate not suffering? It should be. That should be baked into those prices, and it's not. All kinds of things don't really seem to add up with this, but...
Oh, and don't forget the glaciers around the world are all of a sudden collapsing all within like 4 days of each other, you know, totally coincidental, right?
Yeah.
In Italy and in Kazakhstan, oh yeah, huge, massive, explosive avalanches just all within a couple, literally hours of each other. Yeah, high chance.
Yeah.
High chance.
Yeah, exactly. I would say probably 15 years ago, I would have looked at the world as, well, you know, politicians, they're not that smart. And boy, they sure do a lot of goofy things, those jokers. If only they understood more economics, you know? And now I look back on that, and I'm so embarrassed because now I feel like, especially after COVID, the mask is off so much that you almost don't even want this knowledge in a way. I mean, I would never reject knowledge. I'm not unhappy that I know it, but I'm sure there are some people who almost wish, it's like in that movie War Games where only Matthew Broderick and his girlfriend know that the world is about to be destroyed. And he just feels like, I wish I could just be a regular person and not know about this. When you see the depths of the evil of the people who are either directly in charge or pulling the strings behind the scenes, it's almost overwhelming to contemplate. And I never spoke this way. I was just the guy who, well, I'm going to try to spread reason in this crazy world. And now I've just shifted to, I just want to help people survive this crazy world.
You know, if I went back and I thought, oh, you know, what the world needs is a little bit lower taxation and some accountability in government. That was me when I was young, coming out of university,
right?
Just really bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. But at the end of the, that there was something so much more insidious going on. COVID was never about COVID. In Canada, here's an example. COVID wasn't about COVID. It was about getting every citizen to install an application on their phone so that Justin Trudeau could track their whereabouts, find out what protests they're going to, and dispatch police to any protests that are not friendly to the regime. That's what happened on Canada Day at protests across the country. Well, people were protesting Justin Trudeau and his actions on our national holiday. Police just happened to know where everyone was protesting and were issuing, in fact, on Parliament Hill, $1,000 fines for anyone handing out books that were opposed to Justin Trudeau, anyone who was putting up posters that were opposed to Justin Trudeau, and even constitutional lawyers who were putting up banners letting people know that they would fight on their behalf in court if they were unreasonably fined by the Trudeau regime. Those people were even threatened with thousands of dollars in fines, all to shut it down. Justin Trudeau somehow over the last 2 years has become an expert at shutting down protests. One way or another, by saying, oh, it's too dangerous to go outside, wear your mask, stay inside, don't see your family for Christmas or for protest. So much is going on that it's a completely different country now. And it's almost like we just let it slip away from us. And that goes for every country across the world, especially across Western democracies, from Hong Kong to Ottawa. It's just freedom has declined. You know, it's slipped through our fingers like water and nobody even noticed.
I think of the example of Sweden. When Sweden decided not to have these hard lockdowns that other countries were having, you remember the hysteria towards Sweden. Do you really think that hysteria was coming from a place of concern for the Swedes? Absolutely impossible. You know, no way Klaus Schwab cares about one Swedish fingernail. You know, it doesn't matter to him at all. And yet, he's not Swedish, is he?
No, I think he's German.
Okay, I'm just going to say, just in case there was some chance that he had like a third Swede in him, then I would feel bad saying this. But okay, you have Sweden refusing to go along with all this. The headlines are hysterical. The predictions of what's going to happen in Sweden are hysterical. It can't be because they had this humanitarian concern. It has to be, And as I suspected at the time, but now it's excruciatingly obvious, they just didn't want a control group that people could point to. Mm-hmm. And yet the funny thing is, so many people went along with the COVID stuff that it didn't even matter, it turns out. They had nothing to worry about. Even if Sweden had been, did as it wound up to be, a control group, it didn't matter because tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people went along with it anyway. I have friends who've been living in Asia. Now, in the West, at least you have some dissident minority groups in the UK, in the United States, to a lesser extent in Canada, though, of course, we had the trucker protest. But if you go to the Philippines, there was no opposition, none. People stayed in their homes and did what they were told. And you can find example after example of that. So it turns out that the WEF had nothing to worry about. You know, even if Sweden wound up being all the way down at number 100 in terms of COVID mortality and was a shining example without lockdowns, people didn't care.
Yeah, this speaks to mass global psychosis.
Yes, and its effect on me has been, you know, up to now, I've thought, well, my job is to spread information as much as I can. I still do that. I mean, when you have a podcast 5 days a week, got to talk about something. So I try to explain to people what's going on with this and what's going on with that. But now I feel like, geez, I'm trying to liberate people who I don't even think want to be liberated. Maybe I should be focusing more of my attention on people who do have their eyes open mm-hmm. and do want to do something to make their lives practically better rather than shout into the wind, you know, at people who aren't listening.
It's hard to do it, you know. I'm in the same position. It feels like you're beating your head against a wall. But, you know, you cover the story and it gets shared among the already converted population, people who are already alert to what's going on and at least have an open mind, you know. I'd say 90% of the population is completely disinterested in any sort of academic or intellectual conversation about this. Ever since WHO, World Health Organization, declared a pandemic, flip-flopped on masks, said, you know, first they said masks don't work, then they said masks obviously work and you should always wear them. Ever since that flip-flop, it's like people lost their minds. They lost their ability to reason and think critically. And when you're trying to share news with them, death statistics, vaccine injuries, just raw numbers, raw data, something that you can't even twist if you wanted to. They are just disinterested, completely disinterested. They'll fabricate whatever reality they need to. Either you're a racist right-wing bigot, so how could those numbers about vaccine deaths be real? Or they'll make something else up just so that they can cope. Because why would the regime lie to them? Why would the medical industrial complex lie to them? Why would the World Health Organization and the communist that runs it, Dr. Tedros, who's not a real doctor, but in reality is a extremist political leader from his country, from the Tigray Alliance, why would he lie to us? They don't even think. And it's frustrating doing this job a little bit, so I can relate with you, when those people aren't even interested in having an honest conversation about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to direct people to where they can find your work. Of course, you're on Twitter, so I'll link to that. But DutchUprising.com is where you've got a bunch of your stories and also a way to support you. Because let's face it, this is not, you're not bankrolled by some major media
exactly.
conglomerate. You're a guy with a website, and mm-hmm. you've been good at it. You've been a journalist for quite a while. I mean, you're a youngish guy, but for a number of years, I mean, I was just turned on to your work recently, but then I just started... I saw you were with Rebel News at one point. Mm-hmm. I know them very well. But this is stuff that you're financing yourself to yeah. actually get the word out so people can really understand what's happening. So I hope people will help you out. So DutchUprising.com is where you can see both Kian's work and see an opportunity to support him. So if you have a final word, it will be gratefully received.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas, for having me on. I have a small staff, and our coverage in the Netherlands costs us about 500 to 600 euros a day. It's expensive work exposing what's going on, especially when the mainstream media isn't doing their job and it's left to small outlets like ours to share that. Luckily, we've been blessed that there's been a huge response to our work right now. It's the moment every journalist hopes for because it's just been explosive response. There's a bit of a formula to it. It's when something's honestly happening and the mainstream media is ignoring it, that's when you're in the sweet spot. Because you got to ask yourself, why are they ignoring it? And what are the people they're ignoring? What are they advocating for? And if you're able to relay that to people, that's the gold mine that we as journalists, especially independent journalists, love to hit. So, you know, like you said, yeah, DutchUprising.com is where they can review all of the work that we've been doing, from massive fires that have hit grocery stores in the Netherlands to where they're protesting, why they're protesting, who they're protesting, and what's going on. That's all at DutchUprising.com. So, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, Thomas. I love the show.
It's my pleasure. And I would urge people not only to visit DutchUprising.com yourselves, but also just put it out there on Twitter. Tell people this is the place to get your information. Here's where you can find out what's going on from somebody who is not among the ranks of what I like David Icke's formulation. I don't literally believe it, but I do like calling them the lizard people. This is a non-lizard person reporting for you. So check out DutchUprising.com. Thanks a lot, Kian. I know you're busy. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Thomas. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, before we wrap up, I want to tell you about one of my listeners who has a brand new novel out at booksbytravis.com. It is called Yuli Quits His Job. It's set in pre-COVID times. Remember those? No masks, no lockdowns. It's in a society that appreciates free markets, entrepreneurship, personal responsibility, Christian worship, and classic cars with rumbling V8 engines. So recognizable, but somewhat fictional. Jobless, on foot, phone dying, a few dollars from penniless, and suffering in the hot summer heat, Yuli buys a ticket for an off-brand bus to Atlanta. That's when things go from bad to strange. Faith, perseverance, loyalty, and generosity wrestle with fear, injury, humiliation, and Yuli's own cluelessness in this contemporary Southern odyssey. So once again, the website is booksbytravis.com. That's where you can go to find out about Travis's book, Yuli Quits His Job. I'll have that link up at tomwoods.com/2159. And again, if you would like a shout out for a website you're thinking of creating, before you start that website, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. You'll find out various ways in which I can help you get some traffic when the site opens. And also you can join me in a private group I have for people who created sites through my link where we help each other out when we have problems. So get the details on how to get all these bonuses from me for nothing at tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.